Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, Guy Ritchie has a new film hitting theaters, and the directors behind Abigail join us to discuss the new vampire ballerina movie.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 307 of Real Blend, a podcast about nothing. Just this week in particular, though. The boys later on in the show are going to tease their time with a television legend, Jim Gaffigan.
I love Jim Gaffigan.
No, I do love Gaffigan. He is really funny. The boys got to interview Jerry Seinfeld, and that'll be part of this week's show. A little breakdown. I didn't do that one. And
it's okay. He does junkets all the time.
The funny thing is that he's from my hometown. Jerry and I are from the same hometown, and I ended up doing an interview that you guys will hear later on the show, and I'll tell you a little funny bit that got into the Seinfeld aspect of it. But on this week's show, in addition to the guys telling their Seinfeld stories, Guy Ritchie has a new movie hitting theaters with a lengthy title, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. We're going to give you guys a review of that one. The directors behind the Scream franchise are back with a new horror film called Abigail. And we're excited about this. They return to the show. The collective duo known as Radio Silence will be on the show to discuss. I think that's correct. I think so.
Both Screams, right?
We did two for Scream 5.
Yeah, oh, that's true. We did a spoiler, so that might be four, technically.
Four times? Wow.
I don't know how much of it will make it into the edit, but they were very clearly remembering the show and fans of the show and kind of asking where you two were because I was pinch hitting. I was pinch hitting solo on that one. So let's get right into the introductions, starting with Jake Hamilton, who has to make up some ground here in the tally. Jake is from Fox 32 in Chicago. Hello, handsome. How are you?
Well, it doesn't help that I've missed a couple of weeks as well. It's hard to gain ground in the tally whenever you don't actually do the show.
I mean, this might be the first time we've had the four of us together.
It has been in a couple of weeks, I think.
It's been a few weeks, yeah.
It's been a while. Everyone's getting fat and lazy, for God's sake.
Well, we went to Arrakis. We were in Arrakis for so long, we all had to take a break.
Yeah, we crushed it in March. March was a big one for us, yeah.
just like Denis, we need to take a break from Dune.
we're phoning it in for April, baby. That is Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hey, Kev, how are you?
Hey, yeah, I was sitting down with Jerry Seinfeld yesterday. I introduced Jake now before I slate myself. I'm like, they say slate, and I go, Jake Hamilton, and then I go, Kevin McCarthy.
Just so
I
can get the laugh track that plays.
I'm trying to get Jake's numbers up.
All right, so Gabe Kovach, of course, in the producer's chair, is joining us as well, too. I want to get the guys in. So talk to us about interviewing Jerry Seinfeld. Was it everything? Is this the first time? Did you guys get him for the B movie? Because I know he did press for B movie. By the way, B movie is severely underrated. That's a very, very funny film.
It should have called itself the A movie.
Hey. Well, Kevin and I have
the B team.
Yeah. Kevin and I have spoken to him before. I got him via Zoom at the beginning of the pandemic and had a great conversation with him there. It was one
of the first.
He released a stand-up special at the beginning of the pandemic, and I got
him
briefly for that. But Kevin has some great material with him on a red carpet in D.C.
Yeah, was that the Kennedy Center Honors?
Yeah, so the first time I ever got him was Mark Twain. So I just recently covered Mark Twain recently with Kevin Hart. It's a really great award that they've been giving out since, I want to say 25 years. Richard Pryor was the first one to receive that prize. Yeah. And so
did you get him?
Backing it up. No, I wasn't there for Richard Pryor. I think it was 1987 or something like that. I can't remember. But I was on a carpet for Jay Leno was being honored for the Mark Twain Prize. And I had never met Jerry Seinfeld. And so I was nervous because I mean, everyone knows. I mean, we all grew up watching Seinfeld, and I used to sit there with my parents on Thursday nights, must see TV and watch all the episodes and everything. So I'm interviewing Fallon. Fallon walks up. He's also there to interview Leno or to honor Leno. And then all of a sudden, like, Fallon just turns his head and Seinfeld enters the shot. Wow. And it was like, and they start riffing on each other, like just making fun of each other. And then they basically say, all right, you do your interview, I'll do my interview, and then we'll meet back up if we need to trade some jokes. And then so Fallon and I finish. He continues down, and then Seinfeld ends up in front of me as my one-on-one. And then Fallon then crashes my interview with Seinfeld. And the back and forth banter, like, Fallon's doing a Seinfeld impression. I think Seinfeld was doing an impression of himself. It was just like, it was just very like meta. And then the other time I got him, I think it was like a David Lynch event. It was the same event where that whole viral thing happened with Kesha and the hug.
Yeah, I just saw that recently. Too.
Yeah, so that was the same event that happened. So then yesterday, to Jake's point, was the first time I'd ever sat down with him, like in a junket style interview with him and Gaffigan for this movie called Unfrosted. I guess we should mention that it's loosely based on the true story of the Pop-Tart invention.
Very, very loosely, very based.
Loosely. Yeah. So that hits Netflix May 3rd, but no, it was surreal. And I've been watching Seinfeld.
He just strikes me as a tough interview. He strikes me as, no. I'd be intimidated. I would be intimidated by Jerry.
Jake, you had a really cool moment with yours that was connected to Seinfeld.
Well, I lucked out because Jason Alexander, who of course plays George Costanza, is in Chicago right now.
He does
in a play here in Chicago, and I interviewed him late last week, and you know, it was just one of those crazy timing situations. I mean, what are the chances?
Yeah, dude, how did you feel about that when that lined up? That's
it was
insane.
Just one of those. Well, my fear was that someone else in Chicago might think of it as well, and who might be doing the job, you know, but it worked out where, as far as I know, I'm the only one that did it. And so I had George,
to your credit, Jason. It's a brave ask. I'm sure maybe other people thought of it and went, oh, that's what if he just shuts me down and how scary that might be. It was a brave ask. And I worked out really well.
I got extended time. I got 15, almost 20 minutes with Jason Alexander. And so I was able to go. The reason I'm saying that is, you know, when you get 4 minutes with someone, you want to squeeze in a Seinfeld question as quickly as you can. I was able to go 10 minutes without, you know, that's before true. I even dropped in a Seinfeld question and brought up his
There's
his
a show that does that I think you would like. It's called Real Blend.
Never heard of it.
Yeah.
What was his reaction when you said,
what's
hey, by
Real
the
Blend?
Way,
yeah, what's
I'm going to interview Jerry in a couple of days.
Oh, was he? That's great. And then I said, oh, you know, I'm doing it for Unfrosted. He could not have been. In fact, what actually the best part was, he took like 90 seconds to like really think of something good.
Okay.
And people were shouting suggestions at him, and they would say, oh, you should say this, you should say that. And he'd go, no, he's going to hate that. Or like, no, he doesn't want to be put on it. Someone said, well, that's ask funny. Him when he's going to come see our show. And he's like, no, like, because he doesn't like to be put on the spot like that. He was sort of, you know, kind of like, he knows Jerry well enough to know what was going to make good TV for me.
Yeah, yeah.
So he came up with a great bit. And the best part was watching whenever I initially told Jerry, look, I don't really do this, but I've got a fan question for you. And I could just see him hating me in that moment and how, like, you know, he doesn't, you know, they're basically going like, oh, okay, this is part of the junket bit and I got to do this. And like, okay, fine, let's do it. And the way his face changes when he realizes that it's Jason Alexander made for a really great moment. And it also yielded, there's a thing that ended up happening, which we've all experienced, which is such a great thing, which is then Jim Gaffigan started asking him Seinfeld questions. And so I kind of kicked back as the two of them just started having a conversation about Seinfeld. And we always say, you know, like, we don't always love when they pair actors together, but the best thing that can happen about it is when the two just start talking to each other.
Yeah.
It was just one of those, like, and I'm not trying to like rub it in, you know, considering you weren't there, but like, it was just one of those interviews of like, when are we going to get him again? What are the odds that, you know, we get another sit down with him? So I was very, very grateful for it. And I'm very excited to put a little special piece together.
I assume we'll get the sequel Frosted in 2 years from now.
Oh, that's well done. See, this is the gold that he's missing out on. It's gold, Jerry.
To finish the trilogy, will it be defrosted?
Defrosted.
Oh, yes.
Somebody call Jerry.
Why does anyone listen to this show?
I don't know. I really don't know.
I have no idea. If you're watching us on YouTube, again, I'm not sure why, but thank you.
I'm so sorry.
Very sorry.
We apologize sincerely.
Head down, give us a like and a subscribe. Join us here each week for a brand new episode. For our audio listeners, if you want to join us in video form, head to youtube.com/RopeLandPodcast. Of course, we're available all the different places you get your audio needs met. And if you would like to sign up for RopeLand Premium, what it does is it gets you an ad-free version of the show and a newsletter from me every Friday. I will have one to you guys this week. Check the description for information on where to sign up. Okay, so we're not 100% sure how many times the following guys have joined us on the show. It's either, this is either their third or fourth. I'm pretty sure it's their fourth. Either way, safe to say, friends of the show. This is Matt Bettinelli, Olpen, and Tyler Gillett, who collectively go by the name Radio Silence. They have a new film coming to theaters. It is Abigail, and they are on the Real Blend podcast to discuss it right now. Here are the guys from Radio Silence talking Abigail. There they are. Stop checking your phones, boys. Come on.
Hi.
How are you?
Great. A long press day. How's it going so far?
It's going great.
It's going great, yeah.
Good. You guys have a fun one to talk about. Absolutely.
How's everything? So, how are you?
Good. So good. I'm Sean O'Connell. I'm with the Real Blend podcast. I'm missing my two co-hosts. I'm batting solo.
Where'd they go?
On this
Where
one.
Are they?
They are currently interviewing Jerry Seinfeld about his Pop-Tart movie. So,
you drew the short straw. Okay.
I just can't believe that's a real sentence. That's an actual, the Jerry Seinfeld about his Pop-Tart movie. and I'm going to start here because I am pretty sure I heard a Glenn Danzig song, Abigail.
Great place to start.
Anytime I hear Glenn Danzig, I have to start there. Did I nail it? Is that a Danzig song in there? I wasn't familiar with that one, and I was just curious how you guys got him involved.
Yeah, you nailed it. It's Blood and Tears. It's off his second album, his second solo album.
Lucifuge.
Yeah, two. And it, you know, the funny thing about that song is that that song was the first song we tried for that scene.
Okay.
And we were like, that's pretty cool. We like it a lot. And then we went and tried 8,000 other songs because that's just the process, making sure you found the right thing. And we found ourselves back at that song and just like loved it. And it really just does something, you know.
Unexpected. Like, definitely unexpected. Yeah.
We didn't expect to have a Danzig song in the movie, but we're really glad it's there.
He's a horror director. Have you guys ever met with him or talked to him about something?
No,
we have a lot of mutuals in common with him and know that he's, you know, a huge champion of the genre and yeah, a director as well. It's such a fun flavor to have in this movie.
Yeah,
it definitely is. So whenever we get a chance to talk to people involved with horror movies, the day of a death scene, you know, tends to have a lot of energy about it. And sometimes all the cast members will come down and watch their co-stars get killed off. For this one, I wanted to ask about transformation days. Was there something special about a certain cast members on their transformation days? Did they get excited about those days? How did that tend to work out?
Yeah, I mean, there's always this excitement around that. And I think kind of fun way that this shoot was structured is that we shot for the most part pretty in sequence. So it was really fun to follow along. There was all of this anticipation that was building up to those moments because, you know, by and large, the movie that happens before those moments was very much shot in continuity. So everyone was kind of primed for those big turns. And I mean, you know, Alicia's first vampire scene, it was, there was this feeling of, oh, wow, we have entered a new phase of shooting. We have entered the other very specific genre in this movie. And I think that there was an energy from that day on that we kind of carried with us through to the end because of just how fun and crazy and how good it felt to have reached that milestone in the shooting process.
I'm really sorry if you guys are hearing this comparison all day, but I can't not bring up From Dusk Till Dawn. It feels like, you know, this movie, like that one, almost exists as two separate films with a before and an after. Was that a tonal inspiration for you guys?
I mean, it must have been for Steven, who wrote the first draft of the script. And for us, that was one of the things we latched onto. We're giant fans of that movie. I mean, it was such a big thing for us when we were younger. And it the way that they pulled that off, it was one of a few inspirations for us. But to be able to do a full crime heist movie and then flip it into a monster movie is just, that's really the only time that we've seen it. We might be missing some movies, but it struck such a chord with us, you know, when it came out. And I don't think we ever let go of that, like, love for that.
Yeah. Specifically, it's so much fun to show that movie to people who don't know what's coming.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yes.
And having them just sort of settle in, you know, and think they're getting this badass Tarantino penned, you know, crime thriller, like you said, with Clooney being as badass as he is and Harvey Keitel and all the great performances that are part of it. So
I remember people being mad when it became vampires, and I was so stoked.
The opposite.
Because of that, was how much conversation, if any, was there about keeping the vampire stuff hidden out of the marketing?
I think there's always a desire, and I think that we would always encourage people who are fans of something to try to go in as blind as possible. We do that with movies that we love and are anticipating. Like I refuse to watch any trailer for the new Alien movie just because I want to have that experience in as blind a way as possible. But I think once we really landed on the very iconic image of ballerina vampire, we knew that it was going to be, the biggest part, the most memorable part of what the marketing of this movie would be. And I think that, what it ultimately ended up doing was, I think it challenged us to just make sure that everything that comes before and after that very specific twist has to really matter and be really fun and really entertaining. And I think, you know, what we always do is try to steer heavy, heavy, heavy into the characters and try to make sure that dynamic is really fun and interesting and rewatchable at the end of the day, right? All of our favorite movies that have one big twist or sort of hinge on a big twist moment, we go back and we rewatch them, not because we want to be surprised by that twist again, but because the stuff around that twist is so fun and interesting and enduring. And so I think we, knowing that, we really were drafting off of our favorite, you know, big twist movies and hope to design a film that stands up to that twist, but also has really great stuff hidden throughout it.
You know, and it does stand up because you make the character so entertaining. They're so colorful. The Melissa scene where she reveals a bit, you know, that she's figured out about each person is terrific. It plays really great. How much deeper into each character's backstories did you guys go? And maybe which of your actors wanted to know the most about their characters?
You know, I think we all have our own interpretations of the deeper stuff, but there was something about this movie that was really fun to not go deep beyond that in a very like conscious way to make it. I'm sure the actors did their own prep that, you know, we're not aware of. Yeah. But for us, it was very much like, let's keep this the same way that the movie starts, goes almost chronologically, you know. It's the let's keep everything kind of under wraps until we reveal it. So it's an actual moment. And so that those character moments when they, there's maybe three, if not more, 3.5 scenes of basically everyone kind of discovering things about each other.
Yeah.
And for us, a lot of it was just calibrating what those discoveries were, you know, in the edit of, we don't need to know that yet. Let's keep it mysterious. Let's keep it mysterious.
And treating those like twists. I think that was the other part of knowing that
because the reveals.
Ballerina Vampire was going to be a thing, that those reveals, those character specific reveals became these things that we really wanted to protect.
Gotcha. So shooting it chronologically means that you guys didn't get to spend, I'm going to assume, as much time with Angus, who I genuinely missed when he left the picture because he was so interesting, you know, and he's absolutely one of those characters I wanted to learn more about. What was he like as a collaborator? What can you guys tell me just about what he brought to Abigail?
We could speak for hours on how wonderful the experience was shooting with Angus and how sad we are that, you know, that that we didn't have more time with him. There's a contagiousness to his charisma that I think, you know, you feel it on the day and he makes the set so much fun. And you hope that that's going to translate in some way, you know, through the camera and in post. think we found ourselves just really struggling to like narrow down the takes of his, because every take was different and they were all so unique and so wonderful and so wholly him. You know, he was one of those actors that was just present at all times. And I think that he sort of forced everybody in the scene around him to also be present and to really pay attention. And mm-hmm. it was just a real joy and a real honor to get to work with him and to get to know him.
Yeah, he had such great timing. His timing in this film in particular.
He's so good.
Yeah, it's incredibly great. I'm so excited people get a chance to see it. We had Mike Flanagan come on the show one time, and he was talking to us about Dr. Sleep and the recreations that they did for The Overlook, and how structurally The Overlook just can't exist. You know, the way rooms are supposed to line up, the way it's shot. Because you guys are limited to a single location, did you also run into that kind of obstacles as you mapped out the house, where just places where you wanted to go or things that you wanted to pull off didn't become possible because of the way that your sets were physically aligned?
I mean, you know, everything except the cellar, the cage, cellar, kitchen thing, and then the library is all the real house. Okay. So, and we repurposed a couple hallways and stuff a few times, but for the most part, it's what you see. But one of the things that we really leaned into was trying to, and this is admittedly taking a page out of The Shining, is kind of trying to keep it a little vague for the audience, so you never quite know where stuff is. You can kind of think about it if you really want to, but we tried to make it, when you walk into the place in real life, it's this big labyrinth and it goes on forever and it's creepy and spooky. And we tried to give that vibe in the movie as well, where you could be in a hallway and you're like, I kind of know this hallway is somewhere near that other scene that I saw, but I don't actually know where. And that there's something unsettling about that, I think, that we were kind of steering into.
Do you guys have the answer to how many times, if ever, this has happened to Abigail before?
No, it's a great question. I mean, the bodies in the pool maybe suggest what that history might be, but
there's also the shot of Dan with tons of suitcases in the background. It's one shot, but if you look closely, you can.
Yeah, we tried to bury the off-screen story of that history in as many places as possible. The murals representing some of that, the suitcases and the personal belongings that are all piled up. It was a fun idea to toss to our production designer and the art directing team and watch them run with it.
Catherine's scene in the pool is one that I'll never forget. Is it something she was nervous about filming, or is that a day she circled on the calendar like, I can't wait for it to get here?
I think she was pretty nervous, excited about it.
It felt like the moments before like a sporting event, you know, like you're about to run out onto the field. There was that kind of energy around that day of shooting. And we had done some tests.
There were a lot of tests.
We had done some submersion tests just to make sure that the consistency of the goo was right and she'd be able to move. I think the thing that we weren't anticipating, and Catherine certainly wasn't anticipating, is how hard it was to move in that pool. That was really, really heavy. And there were instances where, like, we had to sort of pause the take just so that she could, like, all right, I got to catch my breath. Hold on, give me 5 seconds and then get back into the scene. But it was a really demanding physical day of shooting.
Catherine really went through it for this movie.
Can you guys give just some commentary? I don't know how much you're even paying attention to the fact that horror is having a tremendous year already. It's only April. I mean, First Omen is doing incredibly well. Immaculate's doing incredibly well. You guys are on the heels of it. Like, what does it say about just the audience's appetite for horror right now?
I mean, I think the past, you know, what, around 5 years, give or take, you know, I think there's been such an incredible swell of fantastic horror movies. And it feels like this year, you know, sometimes you have a whole bunch, like last year was a great year, 2022 was a great year. Feels like, oh, maybe we're going to start going down. And then all of a sudden we're only in April and it's like all these great movies. It feels like horror's having a real moment. I think a lot of that is what we talk about all the time, is that horror's not one thing. You know, you can have Immaculate, you can have Lisa Frankenstein, you can have this movie, you can have these, they're all wildly different interpretations of a genre. So there, it always feels fresh and it always feels exciting and you kind of never know what you're going to get. And I think that's a large part of the draw right now.
One of the biggest challenges, obviously, if you guys decide to come back and tell more stories in this universe, is that your lead character is an actual person who ages quickly. Have you thought about that at all?
I mean, she's very talented, so.
Yeah, we're trying to work on the science of keeping Alicia as small as possible.
Cigarettes. Tight boxes for her to sleep in, I guess. Things you could do. So in honor of Melissa's parlor trick, I'll give you guys a crisp $100 bill if you can reveal something to me about maybe a scene that you had to lose through either the scripting process, or, you know, going over the script or even the editing process. That was there any scene that you guys had that sort of got cut at the last minute just for timing or pacing?
I immediately go to the Angus Melissa scene.
Yeah, there was.
There's a scene with Angus and Melissa that they just run into each other and have this kind of siloed moment that is very charming and funny. And it didn't work in the finished movie. It was kind of on its own, a little bit of an island. So we cut it, but it will be on the bonus features.
Oh, great. Excellent. Well, I'll get you guys out of here on this one. Obviously, I'm so excited you guys are moving out into other franchises and starting off different stories. Well, I want to know if there's any sort of projects that you guys are circling that are outside of the horror genre or another genre that you guys would like to tackle. I'll start there.
I think that we love all genres. I think that that's one of the things that's maybe unique to our tone, is that we try to gather influences from everywhere and infuse the movies that we make with all of those things that we love. So I think that all of that to say that we are wide open. I think that our interests are genre agnostic. I think that we will always have a real love of horror, and there will always be some thread of that in anything that we do. But I think that we just love telling stories that challenge people's expectations or their notions of what a genre might be. And I think that puts us in a place to make things that are really fun and surprising, and that also get to be a reflection of the movies that the wide range of movies that the two of us really love.
Mm-hmm. I feel like music has to be involved in almost anything that you guys do. I can almost see the two of you doing a musical, especially the way that this film opens, the way that you shot some of those dance sequences featuring ballet.
We'd be into that.
Yeah. Musical, sign us up.
I can definitely see that. And finally, I just want to know how you guys felt after the news broke that Nev was returning to Scream. I mean, it had to be kind of celebratory for you guys.
Yeah, I mean, excited to see how that goes. You know, we love Kevin. We love Nev. Like, it's
the more Scream stories we can have, the better.
Yeah.
Excellent. Guys, I really appreciate you coming back on the show, and I really enjoyed this film. Thanks for your time. Hopefully, I get to catch up with you guys again soon.
Yeah, good to chat.
Yeah,
man. Good to see you guys.
Yeah, say hi to your cohorts.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Thank you very much to our good friends at Universal Pictures, as well as to Matt and Tyler for joining the show. We're going to talk about Abigail, give you guys our review of it a little later in the show, but they are always a fun talk. All right. So if you guys listened last week, we discussed Civil War, Alex Garland's movie, and we had Garland on the show. And one of the topics of conversation that I brought up was I was genuinely curious to see how this was going to do at the box office, if it was going to reach out beyond the quote unquote film Twitter bubble and reach the mainstream. I think that the answer to that is a definitive yes, as Civil War ended up making $25 million domestically in its opening frame. It is Alex Garland's best opening weekend ever, and also the highest grossing opening weekend for an A24 film. Does that surprise you, Jake, that it set this record for A24, which I'm not saying trades in blockbusters necessarily, but it feels like there should have been another title that had that.
Well, yeah, Kevin and I were talking about this at the airport yesterday. Their previous record holder was like $13 million for Hereditary. Okay. So it didn't have to do a ton. But here, you know, it's so funny. I actually kind of look, that's a really solid number, and everyone involved should be incredibly proud. I actually thought it was going to be higher, like, okay, just based on not just the film Twitter bubble, but the amount of people who were asking me about this movie who I consider to be casual moviegoers. You know, we often talk about, you know, our barometer and mine is people here in the newsroom. The amount of people asking me questions about this movie, I really thought it was going to be somewhere in the 30s.
Okay.
I don't want to say disappointed, because like, it's a number that should be celebrated, and any movie that exceeds expectations or estimates, you know, that's a great thing. But like, there's a part of me that thought, I would have liked to have, you know, just because I loved the movie so much, and I love movies that are getting people talking, no matter what it is that they're talking about. The fact that we're having these conversations about this movie, I think this is going to be a movie we're talking about for a little while. I just really thought it would have crossed into the 30 territory.
Well, then for that reason, I mean, it could have legs, you know. Yeah. It might. The next interesting facet, I guess, will be is what the drop is, you know, right, going exactly to the second weekend. Week if it holds,
it's going up against Abigail. Do we think Abigail is going to take number one? No, I think it's going to be close. I think it could be Abigail. I think Abigail could take number one.
Interesting.
I don't think it's not going to be. It's not going to be Richie's movie.
Abigail is slated to do, from an article I read earlier, I want to say it was Variety, so forgive me for not giving proper credit, I think it was like $12 million was the estimate for this weekend. I actually was extremely surprised how well Civil War did.
You thought it was going to do less?
Way less.
Oh, interesting.
Because, well, one, A24 had never had a movie open over $13 million. Two, the interest for Civil War, at least from my end, and the engagement that I was seeing through my audience and my newsroom, was people were starting to pique their interest as the week got towards the opening day. I remember like my co-anchors and everybody just not really knowing what this movie was. And the idea was going in, like I was like, I thought this movie would make maybe 12 to 15 million. That's where I was at. And then when we did the show last week, I think Gabe had mentioned that the tracking was somewhere between 20 and 30. And I was like, what? And I know that the movie has a lot of engagement, a lot of star power. I just didn't know if it was too close to, you know, just too close right now in terms of how divided the country is and things like that. I wasn't sure if people were going to go out to see a film that kind of, you know, dealt with things in a very serious matter that it was dealing with. And I was just really happy to see the numbers it made. I think it really showed that people wanted to show up for something interesting that they could talk about, have conversations with afterwards. But at least on my perspective, on my end of things, when I was like on this yesterday, on Monday, 2 days ago, Monday, we're recording on Wednesday, when my anchors were doing a recap of the box office for the weekend, they were then starting to say, oh, now I'm really interested in going to see this. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's going to have incredible legs. Gabe was pointing out that the Guy Ritchie movie could also have a potential to be number one this weekend. I don't know that that one's going to strike as well. I think we're going to see a situation here where I could see Civil War doing like 16 or 17, maybe 15. And then Abigail does essentially what we think is going to be 12. My only thing about Abigail is this. I think horror movies have always been a really interesting film a genre, and they do really well at the box office, obviously. But I think this year it's almost oversaturated. I feel like there's a new horror movie every week.
There's been a lot lately.
And I love The First Omen. I think it's one of my favorite movies of the year, but I don't think that one did as well. And then so like, I think there's just almost too many horror films opening up in order, and I think they need to be more spread out. And I don't think that Abigail is going. I think Abigail is going to actually not benefit from that. I think it's gonna I think it's gonna be a problem in terms of like people are just kind of oversaturated with horror at the moment. So we'll see.
The other component I think that we're running into, and we're having this conversation a bunch on the show, is people making the active decision of what deserves to be seen in a premium format. And that's being driven by Oppenheimer, and has been being driven by Dune recently. And one of the narratives of Civil War is try to see it in IMAX. Or try to see it in the Dolby cinemas to appreciate the sound design of what comes of it. And so I think those factors may also help push it ahead going into this coming weekend, or having it hold its audience. Because when people look across the board and think, what movie can I wait to see at home, you know, versus what movie should I go out of my way to go see in a theater? I think Civil War wins that conversation. So we'll see what kind of effect that it ends up having. All of us highly recommended. If you want to see our review of the film, go back to last week's episode and search the Garland interview as well, too, because he was terrific. Jake, you nailed that interview.
Thank you.
Man. That was phenomenal.
That was so good.
Really great.
Kev, do you know how long Civil War has IMAX for?
I'm going to guess.
I just did a search. So Ministry is not there.
Yeah, I didn't see Ministry. Is Fall Guy?
A Civil War has IMAX. Nighttime screenings. So it made me wonder, like, what's taking the daytime?
I did see some re-releases are coming as well. Hereditary has a IMAX re-release on the 24th, but I assume that's like a single day event.
Same studio.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I couldn't find, until Kingdoms of the Planet of the Apes, I don't see another IMAX on the numbers, which is the site I use. Like, they don't have Fall Guy as an IMAX release, but they do have Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. So I wonder if Civil War, that seems like a long lead time for a single movie, but
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Or long
Garfield. Lives. You gotta see that lasagna on the big screen.
That's true.
As big as physically possible. All right. So the day that we are recording, some news broke, which is very, very exciting. Two legends of cinema and, dare I say, future RealBlend guests have circled projects that seem genuinely interesting. I want to start with this one. Martin Scorsese, according to Variety today, is going to direct a Sinatra biopic with Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence. DiCaprio is going to play the chairman of the board, and then Jennifer Lawrence is playing one of Sinatra's, or I don't know how many, does Sinatra his have multiple ex-wives? His second wife is Ava Gardner. Right? Mm-hmm. Ava Gardner. The fact that there's casting involved makes this one feel like it's pretty far along, and the reason why I wanted to bring it up is because I thought he was doing the adaptation of the guy who wrote Killers of the Flower Moon.
The Wager?
What's that?
The Wager? And the Jesus movie.
And the Jesus movie.
Is that what it's going to be called? That's a great name.
Yeah.
Jesus, the movie.
The movie.
Exclamation mark.
Mel Gibson just shuddered.
What do you guys think is happening with Scorsese here? I mean, he's not at the, with all due respect to the master, he's not at the age where he's, you know, lining up three projects to rifle through
them.
Three,
I got to be honest, of those three, the Sinatra biopic is the one that I'm least interested in.
Really? Interesting.
I think like the Wager sounds like it could be.
Have you been reading
unbelievable?
That,
no, I haven't yet.
Same. I'm only a handful of chapters in.
Yeah, I was at a Barnes & Noble the other day and was going to buy it, but then I realized I could save $10 by buying it on other sources.
Great story. Yeah. The death of bookstores. Thank you.
You mean the local library?
Oh, I'm sorry that I didn't help one massive bookstore in exchange for another massive bookstore.
You should go. I mean, I'll plug this right now. You should go to bookshop.org. You can buy just like Amazon's of the world, but the proceeds go to your local bookstore.
Oh, I love that. Love that.
We are not sponsored by them.
Unless we're not. But every chance I get, I link to there because it's a little bit better.
With the Wager, he was going to allegedly co-direct, wasn't he going to like split the duties so that someone else would handle the parts on the island? That's less appealing to me. I'm not sure I necessarily want to see.
What if he was splitting it with Spielberg?
Okay, now that's interesting. Or, you know, someone like Guy Ritchie. Here, Guy Ritchie, you take the pirate sequences, and I'll do the courtroom bits. So Kev, which one of the three interests you the most, and do you think any of them, like, which is the one that's going to make its way to, I'm going to say Netflix or Apple soon?
I think the Sinatra one to me is the most intriguing.
Really?
One of my favorite Scorsese films of all time is The Aviator. And I loved the way that Scorsese dealt with, again, I'm not saying it's, you know, similar in a sense, but I liked like the idea of DiCaprio playing someone that famous, like, and taking us behind the scenes in that time. And obviously Sinatra was also an actor. I think it'll be really interesting to kind of like see what time period they're dealing with. I'm not sure of the exact timing of his second wife, Eva Gardner, and kind of how that plays into the story. But I would be fascinated to, I don't know. I remember loving Aviator so much because it was about filmmaking in a way. I remember that it's probably one of the most brutal plane crashes I've ever seen in cinema when he crashes. It's like, and you feel it. But also just as somebody who has OCD, I remember being very, you know, it was interesting to watch a film that kind of explored that with a character. So I think because it's Sinatra and it's because it's someone famous, like a Howard Hughes in a way, I'm more fascinated to see. And I think DiCaprio makes very, very limited choices in what he does, meaning that he doesn't do a lot of films. So that's why I'm curious.
Let me ask a question, though. Are either of you going to be able to not see DiCaprio, you know, as Sinatra?
Yeah, 100%.
And I'll bring up J. Edgar Hoover or J. Edgar. Like, I don't really know what J. Edgar Hoover looked like primarily, but like that just looks like Leonardo DiCaprio in a movie kind of thing.
You know,
I mean, Sinatra is such a famous persona. You know,
I saw Howard Hughes in when I watched Aviator. Also, I did not see DiCaprio at all in Flower Moon.
I was going to say he's very Flower Moon is a good example. The one movie that I'm always surprised he disappears in for me is Wolf of Wall Street.
Yes.
Which is not a recognizable person. To Sean's point, like, you're looking for Frank Sinatra, so maybe it will be different. But I'm always surprised, but I'm like, oh yeah, like this, I forget that this is DiCaprio. He just kind of
falls. Do you think Leo sings? Do you think he sings in the movie? I don't know.
Because he didn't want to even do that singing scene in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Really?
Remember that scene where he's filming the commercial?
Yeah.
Apparently,
yeah. I mean, you just get Michael Bublé to do it, right?
Yeah.
Do you think it could be like a Sinatra movie that doesn't involve, like, yeah, if you have Jennifer Lawrence as Ava Gardner, maybe it doesn't get involved in. See, I guess we don't know the story. We don't know if it's like,
yeah. And if his estate doesn't, if his estate owns the music rights, then.
And they don't give it to him.
Yeah. That's always such a catch-22.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm intrigued. I want to hear more details about what this story actually is. Because with Sinatra, it's one of the conversations we were having about this Michael Jackson biopic that they're doing. Like, you could do four movies about Michael Jackson, you know, like in each specific time period if you wanted to, and you could do the exact same thing with Sinatra. So I'll be really curious to see what they come up with. The other one is The Beard. Spielberg is apparently going back to UFOs, and he's going to be doing a UFO film from his own idea, and an equally legendary screenwriter David Koepp is going to be teaming up with him on this. I think we just asked this in last week's episode, so it was nice of Steven to give us an answer. I said, what is Spielberg actually working on? Like,
well, I thought he was doing a movie, a Bullet remake, wasn't he?
Oh, I don't know.
I thought he was doing a remake of a Steve McQueen movie with Bradley Cooper.
Oh, that's no, he's not doing Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind, Gabe. Thank you for suggesting that. So this is all right. So what's our interest level in this one in Spielberg returning UFOs?
We should probably give Variety just credit for that story as well.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. They broke it. They broke the two of these together into their one thing. So I'm excited. But again, until we know any more specifics, you know, anytime Spielberg deals with aliens, I'm intrigued. So,
yeah. And I'm excited for spectacle Spielberg. You know, I love, obviously, you know, Fablemans and Bridge of Spies and The Post. But I feel like, you know, the Spielberg that we all fell in love with when we were younger has sort of taken a backseat to him rightfully earning the right to tell the stories that he wants to tell at this
point.
Don't
sleep on Ready Player One, man.
I'm not sleeping on Ready Player One. I like Ready Player One. But the idea of getting a spectacle Spielberg movie again, you know, one that apparently obviously is very close to his heart because it's his idea. I think could be something really special and you know, could bring Spielberg, you know, the Spielberg that we love back again.
Yeah. Ready Player One 2018, coming on six to almost 7 years ago now at this point.
Crazy. So.
All right. So those are two more bites at the apple we're going to get at getting those two. Hashtag if it happens. We'll continue to track those. Well, actually, for Marty, he can come on and talk about any of the three that he would like to. So we'll track that progress as it comes. Let's throw it to a really quick break. We'll pick it up on the other side with some reviews of films coming to theaters. And we are back. OK, two big titles that are coming to theaters. One from Guy Ritchie. It's called The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. And I want people to know going into this, this is based on a true story. And it is staggering how many details are legitimately from the actual story of this. One of the first covert missions behind enemy lines set during World War II. But this is such a comfort blanket of a movie. I'll explain this to you guys. It's the type of story that you have seen before. It's, you know, criminal-esque soldiers recruited for a mission, you know, by their government. Time is of the essence. All the stakes are on the line. The reason why it's such a comfort movie is that it has all the bells and whistles that come with a Guy Ritchie movie. And the minute that the dialogue starts to hit, and the minute that the precision of the action choreography hits, you realize what world you're in and you just sort of kick back and go along for the ride. The cast is tremendous. It opens with this incredibly funny set piece on a boat, and the chemistry between Alan Ritchson, who people will know as Reacher from the Jack Reacher show on Amazon Prime, and Henry Cavill is terrific. The two of them have outstanding comedic chemistry, and it spreads through the entire cast. Essentially, they get recruited for a mission behind enemy lines. They have to infiltrate Nazi Germany. And I'm not even going to tell you what their mission is. I'm going to leave that to detail. But it's one of the situations where, like, once they get to where they're supposed to be going, all the things that they thought are basically not lining up the way that they want them to go. So, again, you've seen this sort of play out before. But the hook is the chemistry of the team that's put together. And the hook is Guy Ritchie's fascination with dialogue and the way that these people sort of play off of each other. The set pieces are terrific, as you would imagine. There's a bunch of big surprises in terms of actual historical figures who are part of this mission. And so the only thing I need to do to sell you on it is if you like Guy Ritchie movies, go see this. It's okay. Yeah, it ranks up there with the best of the Guy Ritchie films.
Wow.
Yeah. It's terrific. Yeah, and I mean, he has a very distinct, like, he has the ones that are set in London in the criminal, you know, element, essentially. This feels more like The Man from U.N.C.L.E. It's designed that way. It's got the precision of a ticking clock, and it's got a cast who completely understands what it means to be in a Guy Ritchie movie, and they take full advantage of being in it. So highly recommend. Really had a good time with it.
Was there fun to be had with the fact that this is the thing that inspired Ian Fleming to write James Bond, who famously pulled from his like World War II?
So Ian experience? Fleming was a character that I did not realize was going to be in this.
Yeah.
And when Ian Fleming showed up, I was like, oh, I didn't realize that. And so, yes, there's a lot to that.
That's cool.
And it probably does speak to a bit of where the roots of the James Bond franchise come from, and then becomes very entertaining to see Henry Cavill sort of stepping into that part. and I just love that Cavill is being given the opportunity to have such a good time with this. And if you've watched him at all on the press tour, he's joking a ton about the amount of work that has to go into his facial hair. And he is having a blast with the delicious dialogue that has been written for him in this movie. So he didn't get to do it as much in Argyle, I didn't think. I think he's having a lot more fun here. And it's just, again, any single time that you're watching a scene sort of play out, you're reminded over and over again that it's Guy Ritchie and his style and his pattern. So
it sounds like it's not getting enough hype for you. If it says like, I think I'm seeing like single digit opening weekend.
Yeah. Okay. So I was going to use that as a question because, I've also seen not great box office expectations for this movie. Mm-hmm. And obviously Argyle is, I think, at the end of the year going to end up being one of the big box office misfires of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of Superman, you know, Henry Cavill hasn't necessarily, you know, become a household name for people, mm-hmm. or had any kind of like a massive breakout hit that shows that he can do more than that. How many more chances is he going to get before Hollywood just goes, okay, we tried with this guy and it's just not clicking with the general public?
I mean, he's got a lot of big stuff already lined up, though.
He was at the Lionsgate panel at CinemaCon, and it legitimately feels like he is Mr. Lionsgate. He is going to show up. This is going to be interesting. He and Guy Ritchie have another movie that's coming out in January.
With Jake Gyllenhaal.
They've already finished it. Yeah, it's called The Gray, I think it's. No. Mm-hmm. Or The Gray Area. In the gray. Thank you. The Gray is Liam Neeson. And it, again, looks very much like a Guy Ritchie movie. It's three, you know, extremely attractive criminals who are on a mission kind of thing. But it looks sexy as hell and really savvy. And
I'm not trying to knock the guy because I like Cavill a lot. I do. But I just feel like, you know, he keeps having these movies come out that no one goes to see. And Hollywood's not going to keep bankrolling him as a leading man if he can't prove that people will come out to see him in a movie.
What are your expectations for Highlander? To me, that's like a classic franchise, but I understand it's not necessarily ubiquitous.
Is there nostalgia for Highlander?
For me, there is, and that's why I accept that maybe I'm, you know.
I don't know. I liked Highlander a lot growing up, and my buddies like will quote it. You know, there can be only one.
And it's Chad Stahelski.
I'm just not sure. I honestly kind of feel the same way about The Crow. Mm. Like, is there enough of an audience for that title and the feeling, that nostalgia, to come out for a new one?
Find out real soon. Yeah. Well, let me quick go through Guy Ritchie's opening weekends, if you guys don't mind. His most recent ones, Guy Ritchie's The Covenant opened to $16 million domestically in April 2023. Before that, he had Wrath of Man, $27 million. The Gentleman did $36 million.
Not opening.
At domestic box office.
No.
Oh, wait. Am I looking at... Oh, you wait a second. Maybe I'm looking at totals. I'm sorry. I'm looking at totals.
The Gentleman did not open to 37.
Hold on. Where am I getting openings?
Never mind. Yeah. Total, yeah. 27 for Wrath of Man.
That's a big difference.
It had an 8.3 opening.
There you go. That sounds like a Guy Ritchie opening.
But my point being, his big titles are Aladdin, and the two Sherlock Holmes movies.
Yeah.
So
IP.
Maybe Guy Ritchie's audience is a little bit more limited than we're thinking. So we'll see. I don't know, but I recommend it. I think people should definitely go see it.
I'm not trying to throw, you know, cold water on the hype of Henry Cavill. I just, you know, he's the most famous person whose movies no one goes to see.
I think it's fair. And in fact, you might argue outside of Superman, his other most famous franchise is Enola Holmes, which is a Netflix movie that, you know, we can't tell.
Witcher did big numbers too.
Witcher is also big. Yeah. So he'd listen. And he wakes up every day and looks like Henry Cavill. So
pretty good. Pretty good start to every day.
Yeah. When you're stepping out of bed.
Did you wake up on the wrong side of the bed? He never does. Yeah, he does. He wakes up as Henry Cavill.
He doesn't wake up on the bed. The bed wakes up under him.
There we go. All right. For those who are looking for horror and who appreciated our conversation earlier this episode with the Radio Silence guys, we have Abigail. And Jakey, I want to get your take on the ballerina vampire movie. I think you enjoyed it a little bit more than I did. But
I did, man. I just had a ton of fun with it. But, you know, it's funny. Sean and I, you and I were talking yesterday, and you know, I think in terms of what we would give it out of five, I think we're literally talking about the difference between a 0.5.
Okay.
But I just had a ton of fun with it. I sort of knew exactly kind of where it was going and what it was going to be. I like that it both it doesn't take itself. I think it's fully aware of its ridiculousness in that it has lines like, "We kidnapped a ballerina vampire," but I feel like it delivers its ridiculousness in a serious tone. I loved the brutality. I love the violence. I love how bloody it ends up getting. I do agree that it would have been really fun to watch this movie and not know what the twist was. I kind of felt like from the start, I had a feeling of where it was going in the end when they start talking about, you know, her father is this crime lord, and the reason that they kidnapped her in the first place is to get a ransom for this guy. And then they all start finding out who her father is, and they're like, oh my God, it's this guy, and we didn't realize that we kidnapped the dog. I kind of started having a feeling of where it was going to go from there. So yeah, the big revelation at the end wasn't as shocking as, I mean, I liked it. I thought it was cool, but it also wasn't quite as like shocking as I feel like they think it is maybe. But I just had a lot of fun with it. I think Alicia Weir, who plays Abigail, was absolutely fantastic. I thought she was really, really great. I loved the picking off one by one of everyone. I loved sort of the trapped in the house kind of angle. I just thought it was a ton of fun. It was exactly what I thought it was going to be based on the trailer. Nothing more and luckily nothing less.
So if you go back and replay everything that you just said, but just replace love with like, is exactly where I'm at.
Okay.
Like, I accepted everything that it was. I liked all of the things that it did. It's a perfectly well-made, you know, ballerina vampire kidnapping movie. Completely echo the fact that they made a mistake in letting people know that ahead of time.
But then how do you sell it otherwise? I mean, that's the problem, is that how do you sell a ballerina vampire movie? I mean, even from Dusk Till Dawn, the trailers reveal that it's a vampire movie.
Do and they again, really? That's interesting. I wanted to go back and rewatch the trailers, like the original trailers for that, because I wasn't sure if that was
now
tipped
enough
off.
Time has passed so that I think you can you can pinpoint people who haven't watched it. Like I love watching From Dusk Till Dawn with someone who doesn't really know anything about it, and then waiting on that turn. But yeah, all you go back and watch the trailers. The trailers show that it's a vampire movie.
Now that's a shame, because that is one of the
so in time in 30 years it'll be really great to watch Abigail with people that don't know what it is.
I can't wait. Then I will give it an additional star when I get to that point. But you're right in the fact that the kills are inventive, and one of the things that we had, you guys didn't get to hear the interview yet, but one of the things we discussed about is in a horror movie how much fun it is on the day of someone's death scene, but with Abigail it's how much fun did they have on people's transformation days? Because essentially there's a number of bits go through it as the kidnappers are getting bit, you know, what is that going to do to them? How does it affect them as the rest of the story goes on? And the guys give a really interesting interview for that. So I'm at three out of five. It sounds like you're at three and a half.
I'm at 3.5. Yeah. I'd give it 3.5. So we're not really that far off, but it's, you know, okay, here's the question. If we were not that this is the barometer, nor should it be, if you were doing Rotten Tomatoes, I would give it a fresh. What would you give it?
I'd give it a fresh. No, I'd give it a fresh.
Okay.
Yeah, my three out of five is leaning fresh because it's not a bad movie by any stretch.
And how great is Alicia Weir?
She is terrific.
I mean, the movie only works if she works.
Do you know that there's like Well, I guess I don't want to say anything. It's interesting. I asked them a question. We could talk about it off air, but I asked them a question that I now realize when I asked it was a little bit more spoilery than I thought, because in all of these and then there were none situations.
Yeah.
We all know that like there's going to be none eventually you know, maybe one kind of thing. Yeah. But there is a fun element to how the people go. And so I'll choose to protect
did the reveal at the end, did it seem obvious to you, or were you surprised by it?
No, I saw that coming.
Same. I liked it. I think it's cool, but I saw it coming a mile away.
You know who? It's weird that this is a Dan Stevens, like Dan Stevens is in this film, and I thought he was having more fun in Godzilla Kong than this. It's almost like he was underplaying in this a little bit.
Yeah, I would say, he's got such more of a serious part. I think he's so wildly ridiculous in Godzilla Kong. That I feel like in this one he plays sort of the serious guy, you know, like the no names guy.
Conducts oral surgery on King Kong in that movie.
Someone has to.
How do you not have fun doing that?
That's a thing that we saw in 2024. Strange year. It's a very strange year. All right. So with that said, head to the comments and let us know what you're seeing in theaters this weekend. We have had a glut of new releases and things that we have tried to cover as much as we can on the show. We got a bunch of movies still coming up too. It's going to be some really exciting things hitting theaters. Some that the guys have gotten a chance to get to junkets to, some, a few, if it happens, that are lining up as well. So hit the comments down below. Let us know what you're choosing to go see in theaters this weekend. And if it's Civil War, let's see if it has a strong opening or second weekend, a stronger hold. So follow us on social media. The Jake Hamilton is at Jake's Takes. Kev McCarthy is at Kev McCarthy TV. I am at Sean _ O'Connell. Gabe's at Gabe Kovach. And the show, as always, is at Real Blend. We appreciate you guys listening to us. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. And until then,
the movie critic.
Craven the Hunter.
Sinatra.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.